Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, 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 everybody. Welcome to the Blog Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and I'm sorry, but God bless America. Tonight, we've got a great, great show. I'm so excited. We have John Bermuda Schwartz joining us. He is the drummer for Weird Al Yankovic, but he, not only Weird Al. I mean, he's played with so many other bands, and we're going to play a couple of songs for him tonight. With his other bands other than Weird Al. So that's going to be a lot of fun. We're also giving away an autographed copy of, it's called, hold on, I got the wrong paper here. I'm a mess. Here we go. It is called The Essential Weird Al Yankovic 3.0. It's a three-disc set. And, man, John is kind enough to send me one. I can't wait to hear it. So before we start, let me say thank you to our sponsors, the Hive Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey, KWV Wines in South Africa, Tees for the Times and Other Stuff in Clifton, New Jersey, Syntech Productions, Lenoka Harbor, New Jersey, Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's Sake, Cloison Designs in New Jersey, Big Big Picture LLC in New York, The Observer Newspaper in Kearny, New Jersey, Joey Max Cafe in Harrison, New Jersey, GenieBottles.com, and H21 hand sanitizer. Go to H21.com, and that's H, the number 2, the word 1, O-N-E.com, and you can check that out. John, thank you so much for joining me tonight. What a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I didn't know what to expect on your voice. You know, sometimes the face doesn't fit the voice, and I wasn't expecting you to sound normal. Working with Weird Al.
Oh, well, that may vary depending on what questions you ask me.
Exactly, right? Oh my God! Well, I got it's crazy. I mean, you. Now I know you were on Dr. Demento. Were you on before with Weird Al or? That was like your breaking point of not necessarily breaking point, but your stepping stone to getting out there with Weird Al, no?
Well, yes. I had sent some friends and I, the high school friends of mine and I, had sent some songs in to Dr. Demento. And the very first one was in 1973 for Pico and Sepulveda. Dr. Demento was running a contest for people to make their own version of it. And you would win a 78 record of the original Pico and Sepulveda song, which was extremely popular on the show. Anyway, some friends and I got together. One of the guys was Richard Elliott, sax player, who was a schoolmate of mine. A couple of other people that went a little far in the business as well. And we sent it in, and it got played. In fact, Dr. Demento used it for his theme song. We did an instrumental version, and he used it for his theme song for a little while because he could talk over it at the beginning of the show because there weren't any lyrics on it.
Right.
And we recorded a few more songs over the next couple of years and sent him in, and he played those too. And what that eventually led to, this was at a time when people weren't really sending in much homemade music. I mean, the show began to cater to that, but at the time it was a lot of old jazz records and novelty stuff and, you know, legitimate releases. And around about 1980, I was invited to come down to the show, and that led to an interview. To talk about, this was 1980, to talk about the stuff I had sent in and, you know, what I was doing by that time, which was playing around L.A. in a couple of bands. And September 14th, 1980, and Weird Al was there that night and was going to play a new song he had just written that weekend called Another One Rides the Bus, a parody of Queen's Another One Bites the Dust. And I ended up playing beating on his accordion case for that. And we exchanged phone numbers, and it just went from there.
Mm. Now, now you were playing in bands before that, and what did you think of the parody thing at the time? I mean, obviously, it blew up and became a major sensation for Al. So, I mean, were you cool with doing parodies? I mean, you just didn't care. You were playing music, you know.
Yeah, I didn't really think about it. I mean, drumming is drumming to me. You know, as far as I was concerned, I was playing the original song, and then he was just singing some different lyrics.
Right.
And it was a lot of fun. And he had, you know, by this time, you know, he had begun sending in homemade music, you know, not long after I sent in some stuff. And he had become quite popular on the show. He was one of the regulars on the show. So there was a natural outlet for what he was doing. And I guess I figured I wanted to be part of that. I mean, I think that first night I said, you know, you should have a band. I'll be your drummer. And it went from there.
Right. Blew up from there. Well, believe it or not, we have a caller already. Would you be interested in taking the call?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to Applause Radio Show. You're on with John Bermuda Schwartz. You have a question or just want to say hi?
Hi, Joanne. I wanted to say hi, but... yeah, I have two questions. I mean, first, hi, John.
Hi there.
It's a two-parter, John. Watch out.
Okay.
Well, the first one's easier than the second, but the first is about Dr. Demento, because I grew up in L.A., and Dr. Demento was part of the fabric of my life when I was younger, you know? And I know that Dr. Demento was instrumental in Al's career, but what kind of contact do they have now?
Now? Well, I suppose, I mean, they're friends, of course, and I think it's been a while since Al's done an interview on the show. But, they're certainly, you know, they're still friends. I mean, I exchanged Christmas cards with Dr. Demento. And, you know, consider him a friend. And he still lives in L.A. And, you know, I don't think they're doing a lot of visiting with each other, you know, over what's been going on the last year or so. But, no, they're still friends. And you know, Dr. Demento still plays a lot of Al's songs, new and old.
Mm. No. I was going to ask, that was my question, actually. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. I was going to ask if he still have his show. I guess he does. Yes, that's great.
He does. It's not on terrestrial radio, as they call it now. He's basically doing a podcast, and it's a subscription. There's not any spots in it, no ads or anything. It's a pay per listen thing, or you subscribe, I guess, to his website, and you get unlimited downloads, something like that. And so he's just on the internet, but he's got pretty good listenership.
Good.
Well, I have one
I'm
more
sorry,
easy
yeah, go ahead.
One more
I'm
easy
sorry,
question.
Interrupt.
What is your favorite Al song?
Boy, that is the single hardest question, and I wish I had an answer. I'm not going to say
well,
I love them all.
Two or three.
Well, you know, there's 150 probably. you know, well, I there's one that we're playing tonight called Skipper Dan, And I like that song, and I'm not, you know, I don't think I'm doing any amazing drumming. It's not about all that, but I really like that because it's a very kind of a poignant song. It's got a really good story, and it's humorous, but it's not just a wacky, silly, it's not about food, you know, like a lot of his early songs were. You know, it's one of the originals, and it's a very sweet kind of a song, you know.
Did you write it?
Well, he wrote it, of course.
Oh,
he writes all of his originals.
Wow.
And that's
music
I mean I you know, that's
lyrics.
That's among my favorites. I mean, it's hard to you know, I could just go down the list and say I like that and that and that. I would say I like 9.9 out of 10 songs.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. Thank you.
Well, oh, good. Well, thank you for the question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And your name, sir?
Rick Ryan.
Oh, it's Rick. Hey, Rick. Well, Rick, we've got your number. At the end of the show, I'll give you a call and let you know if you've won the CD, and John will get that out to you as soon as we pick our winner tonight. But we thank you so much for calling. And it was
Thanks,
great
Rick.
Talking
oh,
to you.
Thank you, Joanne. Thank you.
All right.
Great
thank
talk.
You, Rick. Bye-bye. Bye.
Okay.
Now, you know, John, I had mentioned to you that I don't like to listen to the music ahead of time because I like to listen to it along with the listeners. The Skipper Down, now, is that a parody or is that an original song, you know, just a regular song?
It's one of Al's originals. In fact, probably, well, more than 50% of Al's songs are originals, and of the songs that are released are about 50%. And this is off of, I'm not absolutely sure. I think this is off of the Alpocalypse album from 2011.
Mm.
And it's one of, now most of Al's originals kind of sound like other bands, you know, other styles, some of his favorite bands. This is kind of a Weezer sort of a sounding thing. You know, if you didn't hear the lyrics, you might say, oh, that sounds like, you know, a little bit like that Weezer song or this other Weezer song.
Right.
It's not exactly. I mean, it's an original, but this is sort of his homage, you know, to Weezer, one of them. And
right.
Skipper Dan.
Yeah, well, it's I was going to ask you that because what I wanted to ask was, I mean, of course, I like Weird Al. I'm not a fanatic where, you know, I love his stuff.
Oh.
But I didn't know that he did regular songs, you know, original songs instead of just parodies, because all I know is his parodies. So I'm dying to hear Skipper Dan because I was curious. My next question was, you know, I think he's got a very good voice instead of just doing covers as parodies. I mean, he should have done his own stuff, but I guess he did, and I wasn't aware of that. I apologize.
He always has, and I wouldn't call them normal. They're original.
No, well.
They're all, you know, humorous, you know, or satirical or something. You know, this one actually
right.
has a really kind of a sweet story about, well, you know, you'll know when you listen, you know, what the plot is.
Well, why don't we give it a listen? Let's give it a spin. This is Weird Al Yankovic, and it's called Skipper Dan. Check it out, guys. Here we go. Let's give it a spin. Here we go. Come on. Why are we not playing? It says it's playing, but nothing's coming up. Oh, don't tell me we're going to play. Here we go.
Starting every high school play, blew every drama teacher away. Graduated first in my class at Juilliard. Took every acting workshop I could, and I dreamed of Hollywood. While I read my Uta Hagen and studied the Bard. The boards and paid my dues and got phenomenal rave reviews. I knew the world was gonna love me without a doubt. I was sure that Tarantino would be calling me on my phone. Manny Leibovitz would shoot me for Rolling Stone. But the years have come and gone, and I'm sorry to say that's not the way that it's all worked out. I'm a true Dan is the name, and I'm doing 34.
That's why I was like, oh my God, I can't believe he wasted all that, you know, vocal talent on doing parodies. I knew that's great. Is that based on, I'm guessing, a true story of his life? Yeah.
Well, not really, but I'm sure it's the true story of some people's lives who want to go into acting and serious, you know, stuff. And they end up doing, you know, they end up being the narrator on a jungle boat at Disneyland or something.
Right. Well, I know we're talking, this is your interview, but I just have to ask you a question about him personally, if you know. I mean, was his intention to be a musician, or what was his goal when he started in the industry? I mean, did he want to be an actor, or what was his plan, or this just happened?
Well, he originally, you know, was sending songs in. I mean, he played accordion, he still plays accordion, and
right.
can play keyboards,
right.
Played a lot of kind of rock songs, you know, as much as you can on the accordion back then. And, you know, he sent in funny songs, you know, some originals, some parodies to Dr. Demento and was basically cultivating a career doing humorous stuff with the accordion. And that's how it began. And it quickly evolved to just like our first album is kind of an accordion based album. You know, the band is on it and, you know, that kind of rocks out a little bit, but the parodies are not, they don't sound quite as much as like the originals as they began to with the second album, like Beat It. You know, Eat It sounds very much more like Beat It than, you know, some of the songs on the first album sounded like on their original counterparts. And we got, you know, production-wise, very, very good at making them sound all 99.999% like the original song, you know, that we were parodying. But we, even beginning with the first album, about 50% of the songs were his original songs. You know, again, in a funny vein. But he, I think he's probably always wanted to do that. And, you know, he's one of the lucky ones that got to do it and has been able to keep doing it at a pretty high level. I mean, we've yet to top off, you know, to level off after 14 studio albums and 37 years of touring. And it continues to get better. And that's very rare. Our last album was a number one album. It debuted at number one. I mean,
well, he is the king of parodies. He definitely is. And he does a great job on them. And the music that you guys, you know, the band you play, I mean, it, like you said, it's very, very close to the original. And it's great. I mean, the production value, everything on it is fabulous. And, I mean, I wanted to ask one more question. I'm surprised. Why didn't he take advantage of all these parodies that have been coming out with Corona and like My Corona? I was surprised he didn't do that. Or he just didn't want to touch it because it was political or whatever.
Well, no, he doesn't really touch political stuff. I mean, if you listen very, very carefully to some of his songs, you can probably tell which way he leans. But he generally, you know, that kind of stuff that's super timely, like literally the next day or 2 days later, you know, that's best reserved for the guys that do the wacky morning radio shows and, you know, and can cook up stuff, you know, and don't have to worry about permission. They don't have to worry about going into a studio per se. They don't have to worry about, you know, trying to make something sound exactly like the original. Maybe they're not even doing an entire song. They just do a verse and a chorus, and that's, and they nail it that way. And that's not Al's style. I mean, it would be really difficult for him to come up with something almost overnight like that and have it be up to his standard, which he's got pretty high standards.
Yeah, well, he's a professional, so. Well, thank you for, answering the questions on Al, because like I said, it's your interview, so. Thank you. I love his stuff that I, you know, I'm, again, I only know his parody. So, I mean, to hear Skipper Dan was great. I enjoyed that. I mean, I would love to check out on the Essential Weird Al. Does it have originals or is it it's everything, right?
Well, it's three discs representing the first 11 or 12 or so albums. There's, 20 songs on one disc, 18 on another, and then the third bonus disc has six more songs on it. And it's probably, you know, there's a lot of originals on here. It's probably about 60% parodies, because those were mostly the singles. And then there's a lot of his originals, and it is a best of. I mean, these are the best of.
Yeah.
And this, I think, leads up to, this probably was before Skipper Dan, so that's not on there. But it's a very good retrospective of everything through 2010.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear it. I cannot wait to hear it now that it's got originals on it. Because I didn't know if he did originals. Like I said, I wasn't sure. So I'm glad that I know now, and I can't wait to hear it. Now I got to ask you about you. So you started playing drums at a very young age. And, I mean, you started without lessons, I believe. You did what... most people do. They have an instrument laying around. They play to the radio. Is that how you basically learned, or no? Your lessons really got you there.
I did. Well, it was a little bit of both, and there were indeed drums laying around. My brother started on drums long before I did. In fact, I started playing accordion. Was my first instrument, and thankfully. he moved to guitar, and I inherited his drums and started taking drum lessons, and I took lessons. I started out with the basics, but I had a full set at home, so I was able to play along, you know, as much as I could at the time to stuff on the radio. I was a Beatles fan, so I had Beatles records, and I played to the pop music of the day, but I also had other influences too. My parents had Gene Krupa records, so there was kind of some big band stuff. They had Latin orchestra records. They had Alan Sherman records, so I had a little bit of an introduction to comedy and parody. And I just played to it all. I mean, at 9, 10, 11 years old, it was all just kind of music to me. I hadn't really, you know, had any prejudices yet about what I liked or what I didn't like or what was cool or what was old or what was new. It was just all music. So you know, I did take lessons, and I also explored on my own, and that certainly helped, and got into school bands shortly thereafter and started playing with, some of the musicians in there, which was interesting. You know, like kids today have a band, and they'll have guitar and bass and a keyboard player, and back in the day, I didn't really know anybody like that. School bands were orchestras, so there were horn players, you know, and drummers and string players, and that was kind of it. So I knew trombone player and sax player, flute player, a piano player, and, those were the people that I gradually started rehearsing and kind of jamming with at home, and some of those people ended up on these recordings that I sent to Dr. Demento.
Great. Wow. Wow, and is it true that the drum set that you were playing on was actually from Mr. Ludwig himself?
The yes, exactly. Oh, you read my bio.
Of course, I read your bio.
the snare drum. My father. We lived in Chicago. My father was in advertising, and he did something for the Ludwig Drum Company, and I wasn't smart enough in all these years to ask anybody before they passed on, but he did some kind of work for them, and they basically bartered a snare drum outfit, which is a drum, a pair of sticks, some brushes, a stand, a case, I think an instruction record, a book, a practice pad, you know, and just gave him like a nice little outfit. And so he went, and my brother began taking drum lessons, and then my father went ahead and bought some other drums that matched it that went with it. And those were the drums that my brother had and that I inherited. Now, I don't have those anymore, unfortunately, but those were the very first drums that I had. And I had kept those through the very early 80s, I think. I had other drums as well, but I still had those, right up to meeting Al.
Mm. Now, growing up, I mean, did you want to be a musician, or did you have other aspirations and the drums just took you to another direction because you got very good at it and loved it?
Well, that's the thing. I loved it. And I probably, I remember specifically, I was 12 years old. We had moved to Los Angeles from Phoenix at that point. I was 12 years old, and for whatever reason, I decided that I wanted to be a professional drummer. Now, I had, I'd only been really playing drums for about 3 years. I had no idea what being a pro meant. I mean, I guess I figured you go play and you get paid for it somehow, but not really knowing how to make that happen, or you know, this was before videos and things. I mean, a lot of things happened with Al that I could not have envisioned at age 12. But I sort of had, that's, you know, at basically a young age, that's the first thing I decided I actually wanted to do. I didn't really have any other aspirations, or, you know, in middle school, there was really no direction for me career-wise yet. So I pursued music as much as I could, and, you know, I had some other day jobs and stuff, I mean, as most, you know, artists do, and that was fine, and it overlapped with Al somewhat as well, and I was able to juggle both, and it's been about 25 years that I've been an absolute 100% full-time, you know, no-looking-back drummer. But, I, you know, from a very early age, yes, I wanted to be a professional drummer, and I'm very thrilled that I got to be able to do that.
And what do you think you would have done had you not been a drummer?
I have no idea. You know, I would probably still be playing drums, you know, with some bands or just for fun or whatever. You know, would that have led somewhere, you know, professionally, you know, in another direction? No idea. No idea at all.
Job.
You know, sometimes, you know, people, if you're lucky, you get one lucky break, and I had it, and it had not been, had I not met Al that night, you know, I don't know if anything else would have ever come along.
How old were you guys when you met and did Dr. Demento?
Well, he had just turned, he was about to turn 21.
Oh, wow.
I think the next month he was going to be 21, and I had just turned 24. So there's about 3 years and a little bit between us. And which is, you know, at 24, and I was living on my own. I was in another band or two, and I was working a regular job. And I had no idea when I said, you know, Al, it's, you know, I'll be your drummer. I had no idea what that meant or what that entailed. It was just sort of popped out. And you know, it was a very smart thing for me to have said, it turns out. But I had no idea what the future. I mean, I can't say that I thought, you know, this guy's going to be a star. You know, there's a lot of money in accordion playing parodist, you know, bands. I had no idea what was to come. And, you know, all the cool things happened. I mean, you know, we were coming up just as MTV was starting. So they were hungry for videos, and Al was supplying really different stuff, you know, really, really funny stuff at a time when no one else was doing that. And, you know, MTV had a lot to do with the exposure that Al got, and in selling records, of course. You know, we started touring in 1983. I haven't stopped yet. And things just, you know, I got to do all the things I wanted to do, you know, but, you know, one, make a living at it, but two, got to go out and play for a bunch of people, got to see the world on Al's nickel. You know, got gold albums hanging on the wall, got a bunch of drums. I life's pretty good. Mostly I got to do what I want, and that's very, very satisfying.
Right. Now, the version of Another One Ride the Bus, that the one we hear that became huge, is the one from Dr. Demento, or no?
No, that is. In fact, Dr. Demento was rolling tape that night. And fortunately, instead of just, he would normally record the show on a cassette just so we would have sort of a record of the show. And he just happened to roll like a quarter-inch tape on another machine while we were doing that. I don't know why, but it's a good thing he did. And that wound up on the first album. And that wound up as a single. TK Records put that out, you know, before there was an album deal. Al put it out himself on his own record as soon as he got done with school. He was back in L.A. in January of 81. And we recorded a song for an EP. He had a couple of other things in the can. Put out a 4-song, 7-inch vinyl, 1,000 copies, and had another one, Rides the Bus, on it. Those are highly prized. They're very, very rare, and they sell for $300-$500 if you can find them.
Wow, because I remember when the first time I heard it. I mean, I was younger at the time. Well, we all were. And I said to myself, at the time, I really wasn't musically inclined. I mean, I knew I loved music, but, you know, I was like, in my head, I'm like, this has got to be live. And if it is, God, it's good. You know, I was like, he was like, his vocals were perfect. The drum on the accordion case, you could tell it wasn't a drum, but it was perfect. And I'm like, this was a great production of something that was impromptu, and it came out fabulous. And that just kicked it all off, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's one other thing about that recording versus all of the other stuff that he had sent to Dr. Demento. That one, now Dr. Demento was syndicated nationally, internationally, mm-hmm. actually, at the time. And mm-hmm. and that song, you know, the syndicated show was 2 weeks behind the live show in L.A. So we did that live on the live show in L.A., and Dr. Demento put that, thankfully he recorded a nice version, maybe that was the intention. He put it in a syndicated show a couple of weeks later, and the show usually aired on Sunday nights also in different markets, because that was just sort of the only time that a station could find, you know, a couple of hours to put the show on. So
yeah.
What would happen was the wacky morning zoo guys would come in Monday morning, and if their station had aired Dr. Demento, they would listen to the show from the night before, and they would pull off funny songs and play it on their show in morning drive time. And so now they took Another One Rides the Bus off of there, and so now Al's getting played to, you know, mainstream audiences in major markets in drive time, you know, and they're hearing Another One Rides the Bus, and the exposure was tremendous, and that really kicked things off. That was a huge thing to reach beyond the Dr. Demento show crowd.
Right, because I remember it was in the morning, and it was either on PLJ 95.5 when it was rock on the East Coast, or it was either 102.7 when it was rock, and it was one of those. I was listening to rock at the time, and they played it, and I was like, oh, my God, this is crazy, but it's so cool, you know? That was the reaction. This is great, it's crazy, but it's so cool all at the same time, you know? It was great, and that was it. The rest is history, and now in regard to you as well, again, when did you start writing books, and are you also a songwriter? Or just you just love writing books?
No, I just play drums. No writing aspirations, no singing aspirations. And the book is really, it's a photo book. I mean, I wrote some text for it, of course, but it's really a book of a bunch of my black and white photos that had never been released before. They'd never been seen. And I sort of re-stumbled upon them a couple of years ago and asked Al if, I don't know what made me think they were publishable, but I asked Al anyway. I said, you know, do you mind if I see about publishing these? He says, yeah, you know, it's fine. So a little time went by, and I got hooked up with a publisher, and it worked out. It worked out very well, and the book did very well through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all of the online sellers, and all of the independent bookstores sell it, and some of the bigger ones carry them. I've autographed a bunch for a couple of stores here in L.A., and the book has done very well, and the fans love it, and it really, I'm very proud of it. It turned out really, really good.
Well, he's got a huge fan base, so yeah. And by the way, folks, that's called Black and White and Weird All Over. Black and White, I'm guessing, is because the photos are in black and white, or no?
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
I had a different title for the book. A friend of ours came up with that title, but I had a different title a couple of years ago that I thought was pretty clever, again, on the black and white theme. I was thinking of calling it It Don't Matter If They're Black and White, after the Michael Jackson song.
Bad. Yep,
and I was kind of talked out of that.
Sorry, I'm thinking of, you're right, it's called Black and White, the song.
Right.
But I thought,
arguably the Black and White and Weird All Over is a better title. You get the word weird in there. The publisher pointed out to me I had a title and a subtitle, and I didn't even have Al's name in it, because I figured, well, I'm probably going to end up self-publishing, so I'll just market it to Al's fans. They'll know what it is. I don't need to have Al's name on the, you know, in the title. And he says, no, it's important, because when people are searching around Amazon, searching for Weird Al Yankovic, you know, the book will come up, and maybe they'll buy a book. And I thought, that's why you're the publisher and I'm the drummer. You know, that's why I didn't self-publish. So as a result, the book has done well, and I'm very, very pleased with it. It's gotten a really, really great reception.
Nice. And that's 200-something pages, I believe, of pictures, huh?
I'm sorry, what was that?
it's around 200 pages of just pictures, right?
Yes.
Well, with,
yeah.
With some captions, I guess you do a little background on each photo.
Well, I don't go to each photo, but they're in chapters based on the subject of the group of photos, like video shoots or in the studio. And I have two or three or four paragraphs kind of describing what was going on, a little bit of trivia here and there, and just to sort of set up, you know, what the next several pages are going to be. And after that, it's just photos. There's really no captions. There's no, you know, there's probably a lot of faces in there that nobody knows who they are, but, you know, at least Al is in there, and occasionally the guys in the band are in there. And, you know, it's that kind of book, you know, and it's just, you know, I think the problem with trying to write a caption for each photo, I didn't necessarily know who everyone was in each photo, and I was hesitant to give partial information. I figured, well, maybe it's better to say nothing and just present a bunch of, you know, photos to look at than to sort of halfway describe or mistakenly describe something going on, you know, and have it be out there and have it be wrong. So this way I just sort of set it up in the beginning, bunch of photos, really good, you know, I'm very proud of all of them. They really turned out nice. And in print, they really looked, these had never even been printed. I mean, I always had prints of everything done except for all of these black and white shots. And that's the first time I'd seen them actually physically, you know, on paper.
Right, right. In front of all in one spot, in one place together.
Yep.
And pretty cool. Wow. Now, when did you find the time to play with the other bands? Was it on downtime, or when you guys were touring, or you were doing everything all at once?
Well, it was always between tours, of course. I mean, sometimes we would take, you know, a 8 or 9 months off. Sometimes we take a couple of years off. It just depended. And well, some of these bands I've been with for quite some time, and happily, they were very kind about having me, you know, letting me come back in the band after I'd come back from the road. I mean, they would get a substitute player while I was gone. And, you know, and not that they didn't get great players. I mean, they got some really good players. And in fact, one of the bands, you know, I'd recommended a drummer and I guess he did some gigs with them, and I came back and I said, how did he work out? They said, well, you know, he's okay. I said, what's the matter? Was he too loud? I said, no. I said, could he not keep time? No, he's a good timekeeper. Was he too busy? Was he, you know, overshadowing you guys or something? No, he played all the right parts. I said, well, what's wrong? They said, he's not you.
No.
And I thought, oh, that's nice. So
yeah,
I would like to think that that's the case with all of my bands, because there are certainly a lot of other great drummers in L.A. that can drum circles around me and don't go on the road and disappear for 3, 4, 5 months at a time and, you know, can commit to a band. But happily, in fact, I've been playing with one guy since 1981. That's one of the songs I sent. It was by Rip Masters. And I've been working with him since early 1981. In fact, before the pandemic hit, he was the last guy I played with here in L.A. last March 10th. That was the last gig I did, was with him.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. And I played with my other bands this year as well, but, you know, he was the very last one. I'm in like 3 or 4 or 5 other bands. I substitute with a few for when their drummer gets busy. It's been really nice that these other bands have allowed me to come back in, because I enjoy playing. You know, I enjoy playing different stuff and with different people and between tours. You know, it's not the same just sitting at a drum set at home. You know, you got to go out and play with humans. I mean, it's a different experience.
Right. Well, that's not only your love, but it's a job to some degree. So, you know, you got to do it. So,
yep.
Well, speaking of Rip Masters, why don't we play the song? It's called Walk On You, who wrote it? I'm guessing Rip Masters.
He didn't write this one. This was by a guy named Bobby Omen, which sounds very ominous, I guess. And I don't know much about him, but Rip writes mostly his own songs, and this was just one. I think Bobby was kind of part of the rockabilly Americana family in Rip's circles, and that's one of his songs. But Rip writes mostly his own stuff, and writes some very, you know, quite good stuff in country, rockabilly, some blues, some kind of old rock and roll. He's got some really, really good stuff.
Well, why don't we check it out? I'd love to hear it. It's Rip Masters, Walk On You, John Bermuda Schwartz on drums, guys. Check it out.
I'm gonna put your picture in my shoe the way you walked on me. I'm gonna walk right on you. Walk 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 all around. And each step I'm gonna smile. I'm gonna walk on you the way you walked on me. Well, I could walk through the desert, walk up every hill, step in every mud puddle from here to Brazil. Walk 1, 2, 3, 4, 500 miles. With each step I'm gonna smile. Well, I'm walking on you the way you walked on me. In my shoe leather, get some more at the new shoe store. Gonna lace them up and walk some more. Walk 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 thousand miles. With each step, I'm gonna smile. I'm gonna walk on you the way you walked on me.
Imagine you guys jamming on that playing. That is a fun song. Wow, I liked it.
Yeah, that's why I like playing and recording with Rip. I mean, it's all energetic. A lot of great stuff. A lot of fun stuff.
Cool.
There's a little, most bands, will go in and record, at least maybe bass and drums and guitar first. Very few bands plays an entire band, with vocals. But, this was recorded. Some of the stuff I've done with him, and this just is testament to how well he and I work together, is this was done where I just laid down the drum track. I mean, I was given an arrangement, and he probably played a little bit of what it was going to be, but we basically recorded drums first, and everything else was added another time. We weren't all together in the studio on that one. And there's been a few I've recorded like that. But in the end, he gets a lot of good musicians. It sounds like we were all there just rocking out. And that's a nice energetic song. I like that one.
I mean, not only did I picture myself dancing to it, but I pictured myself just having a great time on stage with it, if I was performing with you. You know what I mean? As a performer, you guys must have a blast playing that live.
Well, we do. I mean, I have a great time with it. And people dance. People dance to his stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not just up there and people sitting nursing drinks. They're out on the floor swing dancing and rocking, and it's just
That's exactly what I pictured, swing dancing and having a great time. Oh, man, how cool is that? Now, how did you wind up with Idle Hands? I mean, how many bands are you in right now? Put it that way.
Right now, that as far as I know this year so far, I'm in 3 bands full time, plus Al. And then I substitute with 2 other bands. Again, nobody's working, but I'm officially in 3 bands. Plus, I'm 100% with Al. That his gig always takes precedence, and the other guys know that. And then I sub with a couple of other bands. And sadly, it's been 10 months since I've done an actual gig. So it's kind of a drag. I hope things bounce back soon. Maybe by the summer. So hopefully by the fall. This was a year that Weird Al was going to be out on the road. In fact, we were going out this month. We were going to be out in January.
Really?
And
wow.
That kind of, the agent booking agency put the kibosh on that, last March. That was already sort of, it's not going to happen, guys. Let's look for maybe later in 21. And we were going to head back out, this fall, actually, then was the second thing. And now it's like, it's probably going to be a lot of people out there in the fall. you know, it's probably going to happen, but everyone's going to be out there, and you know, people are going to be out there really rabid to see bands, and, you know, maybe let's wait till the dust settles a little bit, and let's, you know, maybe look at 2022. So at some point we'll get back out, but it's not going to be this year either. So that's kind of a drag.
What was that going to be, a promotion tour for a new album or just a compilation of everything?
No, we would just go out and just play the old stuff and you know, like that band, Jerry Garcia's old band, The Return of the Living Dead. What is it? Grateful Dead. I don't know what they call themselves now.
The Grateful Dead. Yeah.
I thought Return of the Living Dead would be a pretty good
appropriate.
No.
Yes.
No, them or Jimmy Buffett. I mean, there's a lot of artists that go out there and just play their catalog material, you know, and don't rely on a new album, and they play for 15,000 people out there.
If you guys had any new album in the works, that's why I was wondering if it was a tour to promote a new album or if you guys were just, like you said, doing the catalog and just the compilation of everything that you got.
Well, normally we would be promoting a new album, but we haven't had a new album since 2014. And we toured for a couple of years on that, specifically focusing on the songs on that album, and then came back in 2018 and then again in 2019 and just sort of went back to kind of regular shows, you know, with stuff from that album, but, you know, more stuff from career retrospective kind of things. The 2018 tour was the No Frills tour, the Ill Advised Vanity tour, which is Al pulling out like 50 of the original songs. And which, again, the fans are pretty familiar with, but a lot of which we had never played live. So we had to learn and relearn a bunch of songs that, you know, we really hadn't played in a long time or maybe ever as a band. And that's what we did. And it was a different set list every night. So we rotated 50 different originals throughout the tour over about a 3 to 4 week period. We would get to all of them. And some songs got played more than others. And the fans had a great time trying to figure out which songs, you know, how often we played songs, but they never knew what we were going to play. On a normal tour, they, within a show or two, they know what the set list is going to be. And on this, the 2018 tour, they had no idea because every night was different. 77 shows, 77 different set lists.
Wow. That
was a lot of fun. And it was a lot of work for us as well because we also had done every night we would do a different, like a straight cover song, like and like, you know, regular lyrics, you know, not necessarily a song that we had ever parodied. So, you know, we did Honky Tonk Woman, we did Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, China Grove, Squeeze Box by The Who, Smoke on the Water, Johnny Be Good, Land of a Thousand Dances, Crocodile Rock. We did Viva Las Vegas.
I love
Werewolves of London, Last Train to Clarksville. I mean, we did like 70, we learned 77 songs to play one time each. Every night was a different song. And again, the fans never knew what it was going to be.
Right. That's why I said, wow, because that must have been a lot of work to switch up the set, you know, every night, because it's like when you go out there and you have one set list, I mean, your set list is just there. It's, you just go in, do your job, do what you got to do, have a good time. But to say, okay, on the eighth song, we're going to throw this one in tonight, but then tomorrow on the eighth song, we're going to throw, or whatever, or wherever you're going to place it.
Right.
You know what I mean? That must have been a lot of work. Wow.
Well,
but that's
great.
Well,
it was fun. It kept us on our toes, as well as the
yeah.
as well as the crew, as well as the audience. And it was just a lot of fun, and it was a chance to play stuff that we really didn't normally play. And you know, and again, we would have to rehearse these songs, these cover songs. We would go through them every day. You know, we would do that night's song, and then we would rehearse the song we were going to do the next night, and then the next day we would rehearse that night's song, and then the next night's song. So we were always rehearsing a couple of these, you know, basically original songs. You know, cover songs, and Al liked to do them as much as possible as to the original. I mean, unless it was just physically impossible, you know, with a 4-piece, 5-piece band. But, you know, he really wanted it to sound like the originals, and a lot of them did, and a lot of them just wasn't possible. Like we did Classical Gas, and there was just no way. You know, it was very accordion based because that was one of the first songs that he learned on his accordion. And he did that. We did that in Eugene, Oregon, and he had invited Mason Williams, who wrote and did the recording of Classical Guests. He invited Mason to the show. He lives in Eugene. And not knowing, you know, Mason didn't know why he was going to be there. You know, he didn't know that we were doing the song. So
nice.
we did it, and you know, it's a little bit frantic because that's how Al played it on a solo accordion. It was very, you know, rubato, just kind of very free-flowing. And, you know, we were trying to follow him, you know, doing that. But it actually worked out pretty good. And we have recordings of all of these songs that we did. And some of them are quite, you know, we would make a pretty good bar band. That, in fact, that was the idea. The idea was that we were going to do all these kind of bar band songs. In fact, I suggested probably about 20 or 30 of the songs. And, you know, because being in bar bands myself,
right.
You know, I knew what, you know, kind of covers we were doing and what was popular. But right. And then he came up with a few on his own. Classical Gas was one of his because he really wanted to show off his early accordion, frantic accordion playing.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a little, kind of introduction to each song, you know, and on that one, I think he explained that that was like maybe the first song he listened to and learned on the accordion, you know, the first rock song he learned. So that's why he
right.
wanted to do that. And at the end of the, when we finished the song, you know, Al says, you know, he says, I wonder, you know, that was, you know, originally by Mason Williams. I wonder where Mason is right now. And of course the guys knew where he would be sitting and put the light on him. And, you know, Jim, the guitar player says, I think that's him back there. Isn't that him? So he stood up, took a bow, you know, when we went out and had drinks, he was very flattered. It was a lot of fun for him and a lot of fun for us too.
Right. Well, who'd ever think that the accordion would be cool, right? And, well, look at Tall. Who thought that a flute would be in rock music? But, you know, there you go, right? I mean, there you go. Well,
yeah,
tell me
Al made it work.
He did. Tell me about Idle Hands, about that band. What's going on with that?
Idle Hands is, they do a lot of original blues rock stuff. And that was, I originally hooked up with the guitar player in that band who, I was recommended to by, I used to do a regular jam session here in L.A. Oh, there's a bunch of them. And, you know, just to go out and play stuff that I don't normally play with guys I don't normally play with. And, you know, not just sort of going through a bunch of stuff I know, but actually having to think about what I'm doing and not mess it up. And I got hooked up with a guitar player who hooked me up with another guitar player who I did a couple of gigs with. And his manager, I guess, this was like in the late 90s, and his manager, I guess, liked the way I played. And when it came time, they spun off another band. The manager, it turns out, took guitar lessons and also became part of the band. And their drummer wasn't working out. And around 2005, this was a Wednesday, the manager came to me and he brought me a couple of cassettes with like 60 songs on them that he wanted me to learn in 2 days. And most of these were original songs.
Wow.
That I had to learn in 2 days for a gig that Friday night. And this was before digital, you know, I mean, they...
Right, I was just saying, was it cassette? Where you had to keep going back? Yep, I know. It wasn't that...
Yeah, that was a tough one. And I, you know, I learned them well enough to get through them and well enough for them to say, okay, you're in the band. So around sometime mid-late 2005, I hooked up with Idle Hands and... I've been with them ever since. In fact, I'd done some gigs with them earlier in 2020, and you know, it's nice to be able to get to play. It was great to be able to play with all of my bands before things kind of shut down, and I look forward to getting back with them again. And I'm friends with all of these people too. I mean, these are not just business propositions. I mean, we're good friends. You know, we talk, we visit, we have lunch. You know, Rip Masters lives not too far from me, so I would see him once in a while. You know, and you know, we'd go out and grab something to eat. Not the last 10 months, of course, but you know, and the same with you know, some of the other bands I play with as well. And it's just it's nice. So it's a social thing. It's not strictly business or strictly work. I mean, there's a relationship there, and that's nice too. That's always nice if you can have that.
Yeah, next time you talk to Rip, tell him I love that song. I love his stuff. That's cool.
I will. Thank you.
Speaking of Idle Hands, let's play the song Strut Your Stuff. This is Idle Hands, Strut Your Stuff, and we've got John Bermuda Schwartz playing drums on it. Here we go.
Hey, baby, you're much too much.
good too. That was really good too.
Thank you.
I like that too. Yeah, very bluesy, like you said, but really another dancing. It was a good dancing song too. Not as upbeat as Walk on You, but still a dancing song. Definitely a dancing song. A different type of dance. That's all. I got to ask you another question. What? How much input do you have on the collaboration of the writing, or do they just say, "Come on in, we've got this. Put some drums down," or they tell you what they want?
You know, I have some freedom, you know, with the drum parts, of course. I mean, they know that I know what to do, but they may have a certain suggestion, you know, as most artists and other band members do, you know, hey, try this here, or, you know, try this fill or lay out here or follow me on this or whatever. So, you know, about 90% of the time I'm trusted to figure it out on my own. And sometimes, you know, of course, Al as well. You know, they tell me what they want me to do, and that's fine too. You know, if they have something in their head, you know, and it's their song, they should get what they want. But I don't know that I've ever really collaborated on anything, you know, certainly not to the extent of getting a writing credit, for example.
And what's your favorite go-to kit?
Oh, boy. excuse me. It's currently, well, I got some drums that I was supposed to be using this past year, and things got shut down just as I was getting the drums. But they would have been the Ludwig Neusonic kit, and it's a different kind of a shell for them. And it's a cherry and a maple shell, and they're really musical drums, musical, you know, a lot of tone, just really, really nice sounding drums, you know. I mean, musical instrument sounds are very subjective. You know, if you ask someone what kind of bass sound or piano sound they want or you know, drum or cymbal sound, you know, it's all, everyone hears something a little bit different in their head. So, you know, my sound may not be someone else's, but, you know, growing up listening to a lot of 60s and 70s pop and rock music, you know, that's where a lot of my sort of musical sound ideas come from. And so those are the sounds I kind of hear in my head. Yeah, I'm hip to a lot of new sounds and, you know, sampling and a lot of the stuff. I mean, I've been, you know, thankfully I've been forced into that by Al. I mean, I've had to do that to keep up with the songs he wants to do. And so I've learned a lot in that respect. But, I mean, when I'm out playing, and especially with these bands, you know, playing older songs or with my cover bands, I'm, you know, playing 60s and 70s songs, I want those sounds. So these Ludwig Neusonics give me those sounds. But, you know, the Ludwig Classic Maples work, there's Keystone line. I mean, Ludwig makes great drums. Now, Ludwig's a company I endorse, so, you know, I have to say Ludwig. But, you know, the current drums, and I can't wait to get out and you know, really play them, you know, with people, are these Neusonics, and very, you know, in fact, I'd like to take them on the road when we get back out as well.
How many kits do you have?
I have got, I think I've got 33 right now.
Wow. Are you kidding me? Where the hell do you keep them?
Oh, I've got some kits that are with friends or with, there's a kit that's at the Idle Hands rehearsal place, for example. I've got 4 or 5 or 6 kits that are just sort of out and about, a couple of kits at home, and then the rest of them are in the storage unit, which is adjacent to Weird Al's touring storage unit. So I keep my touring kit in his unit, and then there's probably about 25 other kits in this other storage unit. There's more than 100 snare drums. There's 1,000-plus cymbals. I mean, I've got a lot of stuff.
What's your take on electric drums?
I'm sorry, electric?
Yeah.
They have their place. I certainly have played them, owned them, recorded with them, toured with them. They have their place, and it depends. It depends on the context. I don't dislike them, but they're not my go-to instrument.
Very sensitive. They're very sensitive.
Well, yeah, there's a bit of a different playing style. It's like playing an electric piano versus playing an acoustic piano. I mean, you know, they can make them with the key action and stuff like that, so it feels right, but it's not quite the same. Now, the person in the audience may not really be able to hear the difference, but as a player, you know, you can feel it and hear it, and that affects the way you play.
Right. Because the one I got behind, the one I played, I didn't like the way it felt, but I dug the sound.
You know, yeah, it's, I, that's the thing about electronic kits, the pads, you know, they're trying to get something that really feels like a drum, you know, and it's just, unless you use an actual drum and kind of muffle it and you trigger it, which is, you know, semi-successful, that's really the only way to get something that feels like a drum. But then, you know, you're dragging along a big drum kit, you know, now you've lost the advantage, you know, the convenience of an electronic kit, unless you have to have electronics to control the volume. I've done casino gigs where they have a house kit that's an electronic kit, simply so that, you know, drummers don't beat the heck out of an acoustic kit and overpower the band, because they don't have bands playing too loud. It's just so much background music oftentimes. And I didn't dislike them. I just, that's not my preference, though.
Yeah. Like I said, for me, I only played them once, and I found them to be extremely sensitive. I mean, my God, I just literally touched it, and it was boom, you know, oh my God. And I really didn't like the way it felt, but I did enjoy the sound. I was like, that really sounds great on the song that I was trying to do. And I mean, I'm not a professional drummer, but what I was playing, I mean, I liked the way it sounded. I really dug it. But I do prefer, if I'm going to sit down behind a kid, I do like a regular drum set too. It's just a different feel. It's just real. It's raw. You know, it's just there. So
yeah, there's, you know, when you're playing drums, there's air that moves. I mean, there's a vibe to it. It's not just the sound. And
right.
Yeah, when you're playing it, there's a definite difference. And that's the one, you know, and not the drum pads mostly, but the cymbals. That's really, they're not even close on the cymbals, not only just the sounds, but on something that feels like a real cymbal. And they've even invented cymbals that have a whole bunch of little holes poked in them. Zildjian came up with these about 10, 12 years ago. And they're very, very quiet. And then they would put a mic, a pickup, right under the bell. And that would somehow, and they could synthesize and EQ a cymbal sound. And they basically sounded real without making any noise of their own. But they played and you know, felt like real cymbals. But then again, okay, well, you know, you got that done. But, you know, electronically, they, you know, sound-wise, they weren't quite there because they don't behave quite like real cymbals do acoustically.
Yeah.
And then you've got the drum pads. I mean, they're never quite, they don't quite feel like real drums. So when you're playing on that thing, you know, there's a little bit of a concession. But you're right, the sound can be great. And, of course, you can dial in and call up all sorts of impossible sounds and perfectly EQ'd and perfectly mixed and, you know, in a way that an acoustic kit won't do, you know, it won't sound that way when you're sitting right behind it.
Right. Yeah, because the cymbals, they don't move. And you know,
right.
It just doesn't move. It's just plastic. So it's hard plastic. I don't know, whatever. Oh, my God. So I cannot wait to receive the CD. I cannot wait. I'm going to give you, I'm going to call Rick, I wrote his number down. I'm going to get his address, and I'll send that to you. And if you'd be so kind to send him his autographed copy of The Essential Weird Al Yankovic 3.0, I'm sure he's going to love it. And I appreciate that. So kind of you to do that. Thank you so much. And
my pleasure.
I want to check out the book too, guys. Check that out. It's called Black and White and Weird All Over, and it's a book full of black and white photos of your experiences on the road and videos and everything, right? I mean, am I wrong or no?
Not on the road, but some video shoots. There's the Ricky video shoot, I Love Rocky Road, Fat and Living with a Hernia. And then there's a couple of chapters of us in the studio. And the reason there's no black and white photos on the road is because, you know, we were in a different city each day, and I would shoot color because I could take it to the one-hour color place and get them right back.
Yeah.
But they weren't; those labs aren't set up to do black and white, and you know, not in an hour. And so I didn't attempt to shoot any black and white on the road, but got a ton of color photos. Maybe that'll be the next book.
There you go. Cool. Well, you can get it on Amazon, guys. I mean, everywhere, right, John? I mean, any online outlet that sells books. And what's your website, by the way?
Well, the book has a website, and it's black and white and weird. And if you don't know how to spell weird, it's that thing you learn in school, E before I, that's weird. Yeah, that's how you know how to spell weird. E before I, that's weird.
Did I spell it wrong?
No. Yes. You learned that other thing.
I can't see.
I before E, that's not weird.
Yeah, I can't see so well, and I did it very late at night, and I'm like, oh, my God, did I do a typo, and he's being kind about it?
Everybody knows. Everybody knows what you meant. And then my personal site is BermudaSchwartz.com, And you can know how to spell that by that thing you learned in school, E before I, that's Schwartz. Yeah, that's how to.
Mm-hmm.
It's BERMUDASCHWARTZ.com.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I'll let everybody know for sure. And, John, it was a pleasure chatting with you and hanging out, and I thank you so much. And let's get back on the road. Let's play some music, man. Let's get there, you know? Let's get out there, everybody. We got to get out there sooner.
Well, I hope so. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, John, thank you so much. I'm going to end the show on when I'm going to play that Walk on You again. I loved it. So I'm going to play that again when we end the show. But thank you again, everybody. John, Bermuda Shorts, check it out. Go check out the book, Black and White and Weird All Over. And always listen to Weird Al. And now you got a choice of Idle Hands you could check out that John plays with and Rip Masters. So. Amongst that, what's the other bands that you play with as well? You didn't mention that.
The other regular band is called the Zero G Band, and we do strictly cover songs, and we have one gig a month, or we did, at a restaurant in the L.A. area, and we have quite a following, and we do like kind of 60s, 70s, kind of 80s songs. And it's called the Zero G Band because the lead singer is a pilot for United Airlines. She's a pilot on an Airbus 320, something like that, and she's like a legitimate pilot. I mean, she and so Zero G, you know, not that, you know, they're going up in planes and people are floating around, but that's kind of what that's a reference to. So I've been playing with them about 10 years now.
Cool. Zero G, zero gravity.
Right.
Yeah. I only look stupid, John.
No, I've seen your picture.
I'm always kidding. I'm only kidding. But, John, thank you again. What a pleasure. Please stay in touch. And, hey, if you guys have a new album out or anything, please come back. I'd love to play your stuff. And any band, Al's, Rip Masters, Idle Hands, anybody, come on back.
Well, thank you. I'd love to.
Well, thank you so much. Everybody, again, John Bermuda Schwartz from Weird Al Yankovic's band, and also the Zero G Band, the Idle Hands, and Rip Masters. So great music. Check it out, folks. And definitely check out the book, Black and White and Weird All Over. So all the best, John, and thank you. Stay safe, and let's get out there hopefully sooner than later.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Bye-bye. Take care. Oh, boy. I'll tell you. I just got disconnected. I'm not sure if you guys can hear me or not. I just got connected. I'm sorry. I hope you heard my microphone unplugged. So anyway, oh man, how cool talking to John. And I love the music, and especially that Walk on You. So we've got great shows coming up this week, folks. What do we got? Oh, this Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern is going to be Johnny Whitaker from Family Affair, Sigmund and Sea Monsters. I can't wait to talk with them. I'm a huge Family Affair fan, and of course I love Sigmund and Sea Monsters. Who didn't? It was so cute. And Sid and Marty Krofft, of course, I believe it was. I mean, they did all our great shows that we love, so... And then, of course, and like I said, this was totally coincidental. On Sunday the 17th, Kathy Garber, she played Sissy on Family Affair. So that's going to be fun. And we got a big, big deal coming on the, not that everybody's not a big deal, but a new artist is, he is about to drop a new album on the 16th. I hate myself because I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I think it's Dici or DC, D-I-C-I. I think it's Dici, though. And he's got a new album dropping on the 16th, and it's going to be a huge article and spread on him in Billboard, I think the 16th. And so I'm excited to have him on and play some new music for him. So that's going to be pretty cool. He's really good looking, too. I mean, he's a young guy, and he's got some great sex appeal for men and women, so he's definitely there. And then we've got actor, producer Anis Macnogia. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct either. I'm sorry. I'm very tired, guys. I'm sorry. And on the 27th, my girl's coming. Oh, I can't wait. I was waiting. We booked, and then we had to reschedule. Miss Stacy Ladisoff. I cannot wait. Cannot wait on the 27th. And then we've got Mary Schwartz on the 31st. And Mary is an author. And also, Mary's got a huge background in game shows. And, you know, we just did the farewell to Alex Trebek on Jeopardy. And he, I think, kind of ran the show there and for Jeopardy. I mean, I don't really know. We're going to touch on his background in the game show genre, but really we're going to discuss his book because it's a great book, and can't wait to talk to him about that. And oh boy, I'm going to have to start setting up for February. I mean, we've got a couple of guests lined up already, so, but yeah, I apologize, folks. I'm a little beat today, but I had a lot of fun with John, and I loved Walk on You. I loved Skipper Dan and also Strut Your Stuff. So thank you to our sponsors, the High Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey, KWB Wines in South Africa, Keys for the Times and Other Stuff, pardon me, in Clifton, New Jersey, Syntech Productions in Oka Harbor, New Jersey, Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's Sake, Poison Designs in New Jersey, Think Big Picture LLC in New York, The Observer Newspaper in Kearney, New Jersey, Joey Max Cafe in Harrison, New Jersey, GenieBottles.com, and H21.com. They are a hand sanitizer, and I believe we are getting their product coming soon so we can give it away to you guys when you call in as well. And congratulations to our caller, Rick Ryan. He won the CD, the 3D, the three-disc set. It's, oh, God, I'm sorry, guys, I can't see. The Essential Weird Al Yankovic 3.0, three-disc set. It's got everything on there, originals and all his great parodies. So, and it's going to be autographed. How cool is that? So lucky Rick. Happy for him. All right, guys, take care. We'll see you Saturday with Johnny Whitaker. Here is Rick Masters again with John Bermuda Schwartz on drums. I'm digging it. I love it. Dance a little bit. We'll have a fun. Take care. Bye-bye.
I'm going to put your picture in my shoe the way you walked on me. I'm going to walk right on you. Walk 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, 5. And each step I'm going to smile. I'm going to walk on you the way you walked on me. Well, I could walk through the desert, walk up every hill, step in every mud puddle from here to Brazil. Walk 1, 2, 3, 4, 500 miles. With each step I'm going to smile. Well, I'm walking on you the way you walked on me. I can climb to the moon uphill in bad weather, wearing holes in my shoe leather. Get some more at the new shoe store. Gonna lace them up and walk some more. Walk 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 thousand miles. With each step I'm gonna smile. I'm gonna walk on you the way you walked on me. I'm gonna walk on you.